Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulaby. This week on Culturetopia, a gripping new movie, Austin Deeds, follows a pair of siblings to an unnamed Middle Eastern country to dig into their mother's past. A groundbreaking reggae and dub producer discusses the fight to stay relevant, Lee Scratch Perry, on turning to electronic music. And a made-up story about a new band fooled many people in the media, what that stunt tells us about how we listen. But first,
Colombia's image is still tainted by its long and violent drug war, but its second-largest city is now becoming known for an innovative form of budgeting. As Alex Schmidt reports, residents of Medellin have a direct say over how tax dollars are spent.
26-year-old John Jaime Sanchez grew up in the hills of Medellin under the legacy of Pablo Escobar's violent drug cartel.
The militias iban al colegio, a la institución educativa.
Militias would come to our school and tell us we had to take up arms to make revolution, to change how we were living. I liked the idea that we needed to find a solution to change things, but what I didn't believe is that we needed to do it with violence.
So Sanchez started a music group called Son Bata. Over the years, Son Bata has grown from a band into a social service force against the crushing poverty of his neighborhood. Ramshackle homes pile on top of each other and open sewers pour down nearly vertical streets. Son Bata's colorful cultural center stands out. Hundreds of children find an escape here through free music classes, and working musicians from the slums get help finding performing jobs. Ingrid Joana Jaramillo works at Son Bata.
Son Bata, for me, it's everything. Son Bata is my life. When I started being part of Son Bata is when I started to dream.
Part of what's helped the group is Medellin's process of participatory budgeting. It divides the city up into small neighborhoods. Residents allocate part of the city budget to health centers, college scholarships, and youth music groups that have sprung up in Medellin. John Jaime Sanchez gets 30% of his operating budget through the system.
With participatory budgeting, Son Bata has contracted with professors. We bought instruments. We are creating a music studio.
Participatory budgeting originated in Porto Alegre, Brazil, in 1989. Medellin is one of the largest cities in the world to have successfully adopted it. It's 5% of the city budget. Sanchez says it's not enough to make deep structural changes, but by most measures, the system here has been a success. Alberto Díaz-Calleros of the University of California at San Diego has been studying the ways such systems take root in Mexico. He says there's not a lot of research about it, but he knows that historical factors have to be just right, like they were in Medellin.
This happened in an environment of a city which was the most violent in Latin America, in a deep crisis, where a mayor that had no connection to any of the established political parties came in with a completely new vision about how to run local government.
That mayor, Sergio Fajardo, is now running for governor of the Colombian state of Antioquia. He worries that another challenge remains, keeping citizens engaged.
In the communities, they may get tired of saying, oh, once again, we have to go and discuss with these guys who are boring or so. So you have to make sure that you mix things up. You keep the flame alive.
For musician John Jaime Sanchez, at least, the flame shows little sign of fading.
Participatory budgeting is a very valuable way for youth to understand how, with a resource, I can try to solve the problems of my community.
The budgeting process didn't create Sanchez's group. Son Bata existed a year before it even came into effect, but it did make city money easier to get for him and dozens of youth music groups in Medellin. For NPR News, I'm Alex Schmidt.
The new film, Incendie, is set largely in the Middle East, and it has the structure of an old-fashioned mystery. In French, the title means fire, conflagration, blaze, and Bob Mondello says that's fitting because the film burns hotter than most.
Near the beginning of Incendie, a notary in Canada reads a mother's will to her two grown children, twins Simon and Jean.
Enterrez-moi sans cercueil, nu et sans prière.
In the will, Nawal Marwan specifies that she is to be buried without a coffin or headstone, naked and face down, because those who don't keep their promises don't deserve to face the world. Then the notary hands the twins two envelopes that the will specifies must be delivered to their father and their brother. Once that's done, their mother's promise will have been kept, and they can place a headstone on her grave. The problem? As far as the twins know, their father died decades earlier, half a world away, and they don't have a brother. So begins an odyssey that immerses Simon and Jean deep in a Middle Eastern past that their mother, played searingly by Lubna Zabal, never talked about, a past in which she bore a child out of wedlock, her disgrace catching her family up in a bloody chain of violence and retribution, militant Christians and Muslims slaughtering each other in an unending cycle of revenge for past murders. The country isn't specified, but it's pretty clearly Lebanon, from which playwright Wajdi Muawad and his family fled when he was a child. Incendie is based on his play Scorched, though until its final moments there's barely a hint that it came from the stage. Where the play is crammed with long paragraphs of dialogue, Denis Villeneuve's film makes its most trenchant points with silence, gasps, wails, his camera panning across brutal landscapes as characters have their lives upended by newly discovered truths. I can't recall seeing a film in which I have so often wondered, my God, how must that feel? At least partly because we in the audience are meant to be as unsettled as the characters. A few critics have argued that the ending is over the top, and I suppose if you're a literalist, it is. But the storytelling in Incendie strikes me as primal the way Greek tragedy is primal, shattering, cathartic. It is, no matter how you feel about the ending, a breathtaking film. I'm Bob Mondello.
Incendie was one of five nominees for the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar. In the past, that category truly pitted nations against one another. For example, a German film likely had a German director, German cast, and German money behind it. But NPR's Bilal Qureshi reports that this year's nominees defied borders.
If you were to walk midway into Incendie, you may find yourself asking, what am I watching and where exactly is it happening? A young woman listens to Radiohead on her iPod as a sun-drenched valley in the Middle East glides past her bus window. It's a quiet moment in an otherwise disquieting film about two siblings on a journey across the world to find where they came from. Incendie was directed by Denis Villeneuve, a filmmaker from Quebec, Canada.
We are a small society. We struggle, a small few French people among a sea of English people, you know, so very often our movies are about our French identity culture.
Incendie is mostly in Arabic and filmed in Canada and Jordan. The way its story stretches across borders, playing with geographic ambiguity, is a theme that echoed in most of the nominees for this year's Foreign Language Oscar. Mexico's entry, Beautiful, is set in the underworld of Chinese and African immigrants in Barcelona. It was directed by Alejandro González Iñárritu.
This story could have happened in any European city now. And this is a huge new problem, which is this immigration.
Another nominee, Outside the Law, crisscrosses between Paris and North Africa during the Algerian War of Independence. And Danish director Susanna Beer juxtaposes an idyllic Scandinavian village with an African refugee camp in her film, In a Better World.
The whole notion of the film was to have those incredibly different environments and standard of livings, and yet show that human nature is very much the same.
What unites these very different films is a thread running through a lot of New World cinema.
Experience in the modern world, identity in the modern world, life as we're all living it, does not happen within the boundaries of a single nation or region or place.
For New York Times film critic A.O. Scott, this is the cinema of globalization.
What filmmakers do is try to tell stories about the world that they see around them, and this is certainly one of the big and ongoing and complicated stories, and one that I think lends itself to film in a way, because you can show things and you can show people and you can go places with a camera that brings these issues to life in a very real way.
And these films are global by design. Most are co-productions, jointly financed by studios in Asia, Latin America, and Europe. They premiere at festivals in Venice, Berlin, and Toronto. Michael Barker is at those festivals to buy new films. He's co-president of Sony Pictures Classics.
There's a lot of freedom in a lot of these countries for the filmmaker to express themselves, even if the characters feel somehow spectacularly uncommercial.
His studio released In a Better World and Incendie in the U.S. this month, and Barker has been behind some of the most commercially successful foreign language films, including Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
The revelation of the success of that film was that the younger generation does not have the same challenge to reading subtitles that the older audience has.
Despite that generational evolution, film critic A.O. Scott says films like Incendie face an uphill battle in the U.S.
We don't have laws that mandate that 99% of the screens in America be taken up with American films, but that is in fact what we have, which makes us the most exclusionist film market in the world outside of Iran.
Scott wrote a provocative essay in the New York Times earlier this year, arguing that American audiences are missing out on a golden age of world cinema because of the way Hollywood ghettoizes foreign films. At the Golden Globes, Ricky Gervais riffed on that idea.
Our next presenters are young and thin. They're lovely to look at, which is just as well because they're presenting the award for Best Foreign Language Film, a category that no one in America cares about.
But Michael Barker says every year at least five films have a chance to make people care, thanks specifically to the Oscar nominations.
Even though many times I've been disappointed because of that process, I've seen many filmmakers that would otherwise not get recognized be recognized in a way that really helps their careers and helps quality film.
Danish director Susanne Bier, who won the Oscar this year for In a Better World, says we're going to see more films like hers.
What I want to do with the movies is making sure that people realize that we are part of a more global environment.
Denis Villeneuve says perhaps the idea of a distinct national film tradition is outdated. His Arab film, Incendie, is representing Canada on international screens.
It doesn't say a lot of things about Canadian identity, but maybe it says a lot of things about cinema.
But maybe this year's nominees do say something about Canada, France, Mexico, or Denmark. For these are films about what it means to live in the world today. Stories of the uprooted and the rootless. Bilal Qureshi, NPR News.
When it comes to reggae, the one name that rises above all, of course, is Bob Marley. But this month and next, another iconic Jamaican artist is getting some spotlight, singer and producer Lee Scratch Perry. Mr. Perry just turned 75 and is releasing a new album. He's the focus of a new documentary, Boz Dreisinger reports.
Who is Lee Scratch Perry? Simple answer is, he's the eccentric Jamaican singer, songwriter, and producer behind dozens of classic reggae and dub songs by Gregory Isaacs, The Clash, and Bob Marley.
He's been at the forefront of every genre of Jamaican music throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s. He's kind of one of those unsung heroes of the music business.
That's Ethan Higby, who with Adam Balalo directed the new documentary about Scratch called The Upsetter. Perry produced some 20 songs a week for hundreds of artists at his famous studio in Jamaica, The Black Ark. His process has inspired many producers, including Bill Laswell.
He made interesting sounding recordings that had dimension and they had very full frequency range. And he did that with very little equipment. Very primitive and probably not well-kept gear. And that was the case in Jamaica a lot. But he's the one that stands out. Police and thieves in the street. Fighting the
nation with their guns and ammunition. The use of sound effects and early sampling of nature sounds, animal sounds. It's got to be influential on anybody who's trying to do something different.
I rise again.
Laswell, who's worked with artists ranging from TV on the Radio to Shabba Ranks, produced Perry's new album, Rise Again. I rise again. Rise again. I rise again. I rise again. Perry is just as famous for his over-the-top persona as his music. We're talking about a man who dons a Native American headdress in interviews, wallpapers his studio in graffiti, and in the film claimed to hear sounds in nature, in stone, rain, thunder, wind, that led him to music.
And then when I hear when the cymbal hit, and I hear the rain, and I hear when the stone clash, and I hear the thunder roll, and I hear the lightning flash. That's why I come to get involved in the music business. I learn everything from stone.
The film takes a stab at peeling back the mythical persona. Scratch was born Rainford Hugh Perry in rural Jamaica, and this had a lot to do with the way he saw the world, says David Katz, author of a definitive biography of Perry.
He grew up in a remote village where there were certain cultural practices that survived the Middle Passage from Africa. So his mother is what was known as an Etu queen. Now, Etu is a form of Yoruba spiritual practice that involves communication with ancestral spirits who have already departed.
Those spirit voices told Perry to go to Kingston, where he became a handyman and janitor at music studios. He worked his way up to writing songs, launching his own label, and in 1968, releasing his first single. The song was one of the first to use a sample, That Baby Crying, and it's also one of the earliest reggae songs. Perry took that music to new heights when he worked with Bob Marley and the Wailers in 1970.
Yes, me friend, them set me free again. Yes, me friend, me deep on the street again.
At the Black Ark, Perry went on to pioneer dub music, using the mixing desk as an instrument to recreate new versions of songs. Listen, for example, to Max Romeo's 1976 tune, I Chase the Devil, which Perry produced.
I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase Satan out of earth. I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth.
Now listen to Perry's dub remix of it, Disco Devil. The late 1970s was a chaotic time in Jamaica, and here's where the film and Perry's life get murky. Political violence exploded. At the Black Ark, Perry was being extorted by gang members, his wife left him, and hordes of Rastafarians were camping out on the grounds. The film panders to stereotypes about primitive, ganja-smoking Rastas, and it seems Perry had a breakdown. David Katz, who was initially involved with the film but dropped out, describes it this way.
He threw everybody out of his studio, he trashed all the equipment, and threw a lot of it into the septic tank. But when people spoke to him and said, hey, Scratch, what's going on? You know, have you gone mad? Are you taking leave of your senses? He would tell them, no, I'm just pretending to be mad.
It's a claim often made by Perry and those around him, including Bill Laswell.
Probably he manufactures that just to keep people from messing with him. In Jamaican, there was a saying, I don't remember exactly, but he plays fool to catch wise. And that's pretty much what I think the deal is.
Perry even says he recorded the song I Am a Madman as a tongue-in-cheek affirmation of the rumors about him.
My face is a mirror. My ears are like I see everything with my mystic eye, the mystic sky. I am a madman, I'm too cool all the bad man. I am a madman, yeah, 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 come to cool the bad one.
Biographer David Katz says it's more complicated than that.
If you see Leah Scratch Perry today at home, what he will do is constantly go to every available surface and paint on it and then draw over that and then glue something on top of that. So he's just continually creating something. It's like a never-ending artwork that changes from minute to minute. And that is not an act. It's like he can't stop creating.
So the film doesn't answer the big identity questions, but it does deliver a happy ending. In his late 60s, Perry married a Swiss woman, moved to a village in Switzerland, quit ganja, and turned vegetarian. At the age of 70, he went on a world tour, free from drugs and alcohol.
Make music without alcohol. Make music without cigarettes. Make music without rum. And make music without wine. Then I am born again.
It's a resurrection that might be Scratch's best production yet. For NPR News, I'm Boz Dreisinger.
And this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
We end this hour with a story about press releases, those pleas that journalists get from publicists, encouraging them to cover their client's latest record or book or movie, you name it. We get hundreds of them every day, but NPR's Franny Kelly got one recently that seemed kind of weird.
I got this email from a publicist and started to look through it because I'd heard some of the band's music. It's all instrumental. But I didn't know anything about Delicate Steve. So I'm reading through, and there's this sentence that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The critics unilaterally concur. Delicate Steve is a band who creates music. I'm like, what? I keep going, and then I get to, like a hydroelectric Mothra rising from the ashes of an African village burned to the ground by post-rock minotaurs. Then there's this line about Delicate Steve sounding like the band My Bloody Valentine, but without the guitars. This is what My Bloody Valentine sounds like. All guitars. Then I hit a name I recognize. The press release says the band was discovered by Luwaka Bop's A&R man, Wills Glasspiegel. I know that guy.
It says that I'm their A&R man, but I'm not.
He tells me the whole thing is fake, concocted by music writer Chuck Klosterman. The Chuck Klosterman who worked at Spin magazine in the 1990s, who wrote a memoir about loving hair metal, and a book about driving across the country to see the sights of rock and roll's most famous deaths.
I described Steve as sort of this really intense perfectionist who, like, has dedicated entire swaths of time to working on, like, one chord he heard on a Jandek record.
He also says Steve is a polymath who plays over 40 instruments. I called Steve Marion, who's on tour right now. We spoke while he was standing in front of Bruce Lee's grave in Seattle. I asked him how many instruments he plays.
Probably not 40. I couldn't even name 40 musical instruments. I don't even know if there are 40 musical instruments.
Can Delicate Steve become the wordless New Jersey U2? Asks Chuck Klosterman. Turns out this whole thing wasn't even his idea. That honor belongs to one Yael Evelev, who runs the label Luwaka Bop.
Since I'm really tired of bios for bands, I thought, wouldn't it be great just to tell Chuck to write whatever the hell he wanted? I wrote him an email and I said, Chuck, would you do a bio for Delicate Steve? You don't have to talk to the band and you don't even have to hear the record. And he wrote me back, I don't do bios. And then 2 minutes later, he wrote back again, wait a minute, do you mean I don't have to talk to the band or listen to the record? That's awesome. Okay, I'll do it.
A few music writers thought it was awesome, too. They wrote about how funny the bio is. A lot of music writers ignored it, as they do most press releases. But many of the rock clubs and venues that booked Delicate Steve published the release in full on their websites, no questions asked. And some people that cover music got taken, including NPR. We fell for the 40 instruments line. So were we all just lazy?
The whole idea of public relations is to stop journalism.
Chuck Klosterman.
It's to basically give journalists an opportunity to write something without really asking any critical questions. So that's why doing this, I mean, I wouldn't say it's like a media hoax or something because no one in the media really cared.
I care. And I bet all the other writers and people who buy music and tickets to shows out there who fell for this fiction care too.
One person asked me, will you feel bad if someone goes to this show or buys this record based on the fact that you wrote this fictional piece? I'll be honest, I don't feel bad because to me, I've probably helped the person to learn that you should not make consumer decisions based on some random media message that someone just fabricated.
Right. But one of the reasons Klosterman was able to pull this off in the first place is that we need stories about music, and they really do change how we hear it. Michael Beckerman is the chair of the music department at New York University. He's done research on this very subject. 5 years ago, he invited a group of people to listen to a piece of music in a church in Germany. He gave program notes to half of the audience that told them the piece they were about to hear was written in a concentration camp by a composer who was sent to Auschwitz only days later, where he died. He told the other half nothing other than the composer's name.
Afterwards, we interviewed everybody. And the people who didn't get program notes thought it was sort of a sweet, lovely, folksy Eastern European piece. And the people who got program notes almost uniformly tended to understand it as one of the great tragic statements of the century.
He plays another example.
You have something like this. Now, what role would it play if I told you the title of this was called Dark Blue World? And what if I further told you that it was written by a Czech jazz pianist around 1929? And what if I told you that the jazz pianist was himself nearly blind and that Dark Blue World became his kind of personal anthem? So... Well, you might listen to it differently.
But what if the story behind the music just isn't that interesting?
I call it a Delicate Steve because I had a recording studio that was called Delicate Studios, and everybody that I played the music with were all really good friends, so that's Delicate Steve. Kind of a boring story, like every other band, I guess.
So somebody came up with a better story, and a few more people listened to the music than maybe would have otherwise. Was it a good-natured prank or a lie? Franny Kelly, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.